This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, what's your friend count on social media? Do you feel like you manage your online relationships well? Our guest says the scope of our online connections can be too much for our brains to handle, and that could be dragging down society. He's got some ideas for fixing broken social media. Now, back in 2019, the nation's first major trial over the opioid crisis landed squarely in favor of plaintiffs, arguing that a drug maker knowingly caused harm. A district judge in Oklahoma ruled against Johnson & Johnson and fined the company hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, that case has been overturned by the state's Supreme Court, which doesn't bode well for other challenges in states around the country under similar laws. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think manufacturers and distributors of opioid prescription drugs should be held responsible for the opioid addiction crisis? What about doctors or pharmacies that distribute opioids? What questions do you have about the many court challenges going on right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lenny Bernstein is a health and medicine reporter at the Washington Post. He's been covering the opioid epidemic for years now. Lenny, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, back in 2019, you were reporting, Lenny, on this case in Oklahoma. It was a big deal. Talk us through that case and why it was seen as something with a lot of implications nationwide.
Sure. That was the first state trial, really the first trial of any kind in a very long time, where plaintiffs tried to put the responsibility for all the damage of the opioid epidemic onto the drug companies that had produced the opioids that many people took for pain. It started out with many companies, and gradually through settlements and other pretrial motions, it became just Johnson & Johnson, the giant health company. And so it was closely watched around the country because, A, they were taking on a very large drug company and trying to get some kind of recompense for all the overdose deaths and all the other kinds of damage. And also, it was a very creative use of a new law.
And talk about the law. This is a public nuisance law, as I understand it, that Johnson & Johnson was challenged under.
Right. So every state has these public nuisance laws. And the way to think about them is if someone in your neighborhood is doing something that harms the general good in that neighborhood, that is what public nuisance laws have been used for traditionally over many years. So if you've got the guy in your neighborhood who plays his music at 2 a.m. and keeps up everybody for blocks around, he can be determined to be a public nuisance, and he can be prosecuted for that. What the plaintiffs did, the state of Oklahoma in this case, was they used that very old law in a very new way. And they said Johnson & Johnson and other drug companies had created a public nuisance by pouring opioids into the community and then deceptively marketing them in ways that were harmful. And so we have suffered overdoses and we have suffered deaths, and the cops have to come and the government has to pay for naloxone, which is the antidote that counteracts overdoses. There are education efforts. All of these things at least are partly the responsibility of the producers of these opioids.
Have we seen public nuisance suits in other states following suit, I guess, of what we saw in Oklahoma?
Yes, there actually was one that predated Oklahoma, but it was decided just the other day. It was decided much later. And that was in California, where three counties and the city of Oakland did the same thing. And they sued a handful of drug companies. It ended up being four, I believe, under the same theory. Under the exact same circumstances. And then other states are using this theory as well. New York, Ohio, there's a West Virginia case against distributors that is before a judge now. In other words, the testimony has finished and the judge is considering his ruling. So yes, you're seeing them still going on in this country. Then there were thousands and thousands of other cases that were filed, but have not come to trial and may actually be part of this gigantic mass settlement that also is in process right now.
Now, this Oklahoma public nuisance suit worked originally in one court, and I think that made a lot of people think it could work in other states. But now here we are this week. The Oklahoma State Supreme Court overturned that ruling. What did they say about that decision?
The Supreme Court said several things, but the main one is this. They said Johnson & Johnson is producing a legal, highly regulated product and sending it downstream into the community where some people, many people, are using it for the legitimate reason of addressing pain. How can Johnson & Johnson be held responsible for what happens to that product as it moves downstream through the hands of distributors and pharmacists and doctors? And by the way, it's legal and highly regulated. Why should they be responsible? Why should they be accused of creating a public nuisance with their perfectly legal product? And it was a 5-1 decision, and the dissenter only dissented because he thought the case should be sent back to the trial court level. So in effect, you know, this was an overwhelming decision on behalf of the drug company, for the drug company.
We're talking to Lenny Bernstein with the Washington Post, looking at lawsuits involving drug manufacturers and distributors related to the opioid epidemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with that court decision we just heard about, a state Supreme Court in Oklahoma saying it's a legal product, don't hold manufacturers responsible for the downstream impact? Or do you agree with plaintiffs in cases like these that there was deceptive marketing, deception about the addictive properties of these medications? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Lenny, that's Oklahoma. You mentioned that big lawsuit. I think you're talking about the one that the state of Wisconsin is part of, involving a bunch of drug, not just manufacturers, but distributors as well. What's going on there, and where is it right now?
There is a multi-district litigation involving thousands of plaintiffs, literally thousands of plaintiffs. There are states, counties, cities, Native American tribes, other jurisdictions, and they have all tentatively agreed to settle their case against the three big drug distributors, McKesson, Cardinal, and AmerisourceBergen, for $21 billion. And separately, but connected, against Johnson & Johnson for $5 billion. And many of them have pursued this public nuisance strategy. Well, as you can pretty much see very clearly, if you're on the fence, if you're one of those counties that hadn't ratified the settlement yet, or one of those states that hasn't ratified the settlement yet, and you're seeing what happened over the last 10 days, in which public nuisance was struck down in two separate jurisdictions, you might want to sign on to that settlement right now. You might say, you know, it didn't look as good as it did a year ago or 2 years ago when Oklahoma won $465 million and had this nice pot of money to help abate the opioid crisis. And maybe we ought to sign on and get what we can get right now. So while state decisions, even though this was the Supreme Court of Oklahoma and a lower district court in California, while state decisions are not binding on other states, lawyers do watch to see which way things are trending. And if other judges come out and say, this theory doesn't work, you can't apply this to drug companies, then it may have some influence on that settlement.
I want to talk about the distributors in this. The manufacturers are maybe household names. The McKessons and Cardinals, except for those of us who used to work in pharmacies, not household names. Some of the specific claims involve, I think, accusations that they were distributing these drugs kind of willy-nilly, not paying attention to the ways that they were diverted into the black market. Can you talk about that angle of the story?
Sure. These are there are several hundred or maybe 100 distributors, but the big three control 85 or 90% of the market. And these are the biggest companies that you've never heard of. Mm-hmm. McKesson is something around the fifth largest company in America, and Cardinal and AmerisourceBergen are close behind. The law that created the closed system for prescription opioids, the 1972, I believe it was, put the onus for controlling these drugs, the flow of these drugs, squarely on the distributors. And that makes sense because the manufacturers pass them on to the distributors, distributors pass them on to the doctors, nursing homes, pharmacies that that sell them to you and me. Well, so they are sort of gatekeepers. They have their, they're in the middle of the supply chain and they can see what's going on. Well, what happened over many years, again and again and again, is that they kind of turned their heads when there was clear evidence of malfeasance or wrongdoing. So if a pharmacy was ordering 10,000 oxycodone 1 month, and then 100,000 oxycodone the next month, and to be clear, I'm making up those numbers, that is clear evidence of a suspicious order. And what the distributors were supposed to do was hold back the drugs, report it to the DEA, get it checked out, make sure this wasn't a rogue pharmacist who was selling drugs for cash to people who use drugs. And in many cases, they didn't do that. And so they turned out that a lot of these guys were not doing their jobs, and they had to settle with the DEA, which came in and prosecuted them. And now, as I mentioned before, they also were sued and are part of this larger settlement.
We're talking to Washington Post health and medicine reporter Lenny Bernstein about the ongoing opioid crisis and the reversal of a major court ruling that had originally held a company liable in one state. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on these suits and whether the companies that manufactured the opioids and marketed them, the companies that distributed them, should be held liable, should have to pay communities money for the damage that was done by the addiction crisis. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Washington Post health and medicine reporter Lenny Bernstein about the reversal of a 2019 landmark ruling against a drug maker for their role in the opioid crisis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these lawsuits against drug manufacturers and distributors over opioid drugs? Did you see a big impact of this opioid crisis in your community, in your family? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Steve is with us in Madison. Steve, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Steve. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. As I've been listening to this comments about the opioid crisis and, you know, the drug makers and such, and I believe the drug companies, I think, knew about the addiction of these drugs, and the continual use of these drugs would be harmful in the long term, meaning as you use these drugs, the prescription dosage goes up, your body gets used to it, and your body needs it, and sometimes your body goes into a state where, well, you go into depression, you can't work, you have to be on the drug, you don't want to be on the drug, there again causes more depression, anxieties, and I just believe that, I have a daughter that's involved with this, and it's hard on the families all the way around, not only on the person that's addicted to these drugs. But I think, I don't know that I hold the doctors responsible. Yeah, well, I guess if they knew that it was addictive, they should have possibly draw back on the amount of usage on these drugs. But as far as a person, when you're in pain, you know, you want to use something and go forward, but I just believe that these companies knew all these opioids were addictive.
Steve, thanks so much for sharing your story. Best to your family and your daughter. Lenny, this is kind of a core issue, right? What did drug companies know about the addictive properties of these medications versus what they were telling doctors about the addictive properties of these medications?
Yeah, and to your caller, I think his name was Steve. I'm really sorry to hear this story. I've interviewed many, many, many people who've expressed the same thing. Early on in the epidemic, it became clear to some of the drug companies that they were aware of the addictive, some of the drug companies, that these products were highly addictive. Now, you've probably seen enough about the Purdue story in recent movies and books to know that they have been accused, and in some cases, settled cases in which they went out and very aggressively denied the addictive properties of these drugs. They twisted a research letter from a medical journal and convinced many doctors at a time when we were trying as a society to better address pain that these drugs could be used for moderate pain, some kinds of daily aches and pains. That's not what they're for. These are powerful, powerful drugs, and they're supposed to be used for cancer pain, for end-of-life pain, and that's not what happened. They were deceptively marketed in many cases as being perfectly safe for pain that's of other kinds, much more beyond just those severe pains. And some people have brain chemistry that addicts them to these drugs very, very quickly. I've interviewed people who said, you know, I took my kid for a soccer injury, a shoulder, a dislocation, and within a few days, that kid was hooked. And as your caller mentioned, you know, this is not what those drugs were for, and you become dependent, and it gets very hard to get off of them.
Steve, thanks again for calling and sharing your story. Lenny, I want to talk about the current state of the opioid addiction crisis. In a lot of ways, it seems like we've moved on. Maybe people who originally got addicted to a prescription medication, one that's prescribed for them, or off the black market, that seems less common, and we're moving on more toward these full-on illegal drugs, often imported from overseas. What are you seeing now?
Yeah, we talk about the opioid epidemic in this country in three phases. There was the prescription drug phase in the early 2000s, where very little was being done as these drugs sort of poured over the internet and into pharmacies, and people could get their hands on them, and some people became addicted. The DEA cracked down on that. The epidemic moved into heroin. It was cheaper. It got the same, people got the same high out of it. But of course, we all know the problems with heroin. And then now fentanyl was introduced, illegal fentanyl, not medical fentanyl, which has a real use in medicine, but illegal synthesized fentanyl was introduced into this country. It's many, many more times addictive than morphine. And it is the main problem now in 2021, has been for several years. The last report we have, the last full year report we have from the government, from the CDC, is 93,000 people died of overdoses to drugs in this country, and about two-thirds of those were opioids. That's a staggering, staggering number. Of course, the COVID pandemic has had an impact on it. And we always have to remember that for each death, there are family members left behind. In other cases, there were overdoses that didn't result in death, but still had grave damage on the person and their family. So this is a huge crisis in the United States. And unfortunately, it is only getting worse.
Bringing things back around to these lawsuits now, Lenny, was the goal as these settlements come in, as the suits came out, to take this money and then use it to help treat people, to provide more options, more roads for people to get unaddicted?
Exactly right. You under public nuisance law, you can't make someone pay for previous damage, right? You can't make someone pay for keeping all of us up at night with their loud music or whatever the nuisance was. But you can make them pay to abate the damage. So in the case of drugs, well, of course, we can't pay for the past overdoses, but what we can do is take their money, put it into treatment, put it into distribution of naloxone, that's the opioid antidote, the overdose antidote. We can put it into clean needles. We can put it into education. We can put it into all the ancillary services that go along with treatment and prevention. And that was the idea. And in fact, when the state won $465 million from Johnson & Johnson, there was a whole list of how that money was going to be spent in the state of Oklahoma. Now, of course, that won't happen, but it remains to be seen what happens in other places.
In just our last minute or so, Lenny, what are you watching for next in these ongoing lawsuits and settlement negotiations?
Well, I'm watching to make sure that enough counties and states sign on to the settlement that it goes through, and so that most of the cases will be taken care of. I'm watching to see what the next round of decisions are from judges. And if it keeps going in the company's favor, I think that will have an impact on the way things go. And then waiting to see the first jury. There hasn't been a jury decision yet. So will 12 jurors see this differently than individual judges?
Where is a jury trial in the works that you have your eye on?
New York.
All right, Lenny, we'll keep watching. Thanks for joining us again today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Talking to Lenny Bernstein, health and medicine reporter at the Washington Post. He's been covering the opioid epidemic, as we heard, for years now. He talked to us about the reversal of a major state ruling against the drug company Johnson & Johnson. It had been the original ruling a couple years back was viewed as maybe a big precedent, and now so is the reversal of that rule. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, get two takes on tax-related issues. There's a new investigative report on tax credits that have helped some of the wealthiest Americans. And we'll look at the impact of short-term family tax credits and whether or not they should be extended. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 with Kate Archer-Kent here on the Ideas Network. Time for another update in the ongoing saga of the giant Long Island cheese pumpkin. The story so far, I got this huge edible pumpkin, shape and color of a wheel of cheese from my CSA farmer. As I've mentioned in the past, I cooked it down. My freezer is full of it. Update, I told the farmer in a survey, I like the pumpkin. As a reward for filling out the survey, I got another Long Island cheese pumpkin. Not quite as huge as the first one, but still pretty big. So I cooked that down on Monday. A quarter of it turned into a big pot of soup with a bunch of cilantro. As the youth say, good soup. Half of it I added into the already full freezer pumpkin, and the remainder is in my fridge for a food project to be named later. Maybe pie. It's pumpkin news you can use. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, Texas is taking action to remove certain books from its school libraries, but is any push to ban books bound to backfire? We'll hear from three authors who have faced book bans themselves. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, there's been a lot of criticism of social media platforms lately and the impact they have on our personal well-being and on society at large. Our next guest says a lot of the solutions offered don't get at a basic problem with social media. It's too big. Social media platforms allow us to say as much as we want and consume as much as we want with an unlimited audience. They encourage us to give and receive communication nonstop. And maybe our brains weren't built for that. Maybe we need smaller, slower platforms. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you were monarch of social media for a day, what would you change? Would you try to clean up the place? How would you describe the majority of the connections or relationships you have with people on social media? call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ian Bogost is director of the program in Film and Media Studies at Washington University in St. Louis. He's a contributing writer for The Atlantic. His latest book is called Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games. His recent piece in The Atlantic is called People Aren't Meant to Talk This Much. Ian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Can you start by talking about this concept of mega scale that you lay out in the piece that we encounter on social media?
Yes, technology companies want to be as big as possible. And this is relatively new in human civilization to have companies that service billions of customers all around the globe. And that goal of being as big as possible and reaching as many people as possible has sort of been transferred from these technology companies' business models down to the desires of their users. You want to have as many friends as you can on Facebook or as many followers on Twitter and Instagram as you can get. You want to process all that information by reading your feeds and getting your stuff out there to thousands or even millions of people every day. Not just a very large user base, as my colleague at The Atlantic, Adrian LaFrance, calls it, but an unprecedented one, one that's never been bigger in human history.
Compare that to what psychology tells us about how many relationships we're usually used to managing, close or slightly less close.
It's a lot less. And one of the examples I use in this piece is from a British psychologist named Robin Dunbar, who's famous for this idea of Dunbar's number. And that is 150. Basically, Dunbar's claim was you can have up to, at a maximum, maybe 150 productive bonds with other people. And that's where the human brain starts to shut down. It just can't have meaningful relationships beyond that. But actually, that number, even that 150 number, is big. And most of the conversations, the deep, meaningful connections you have are with a much smaller circle, about, you know, 5 to 15 family members, close friends, and so on. But even if you don't buy Dunbar's specific take, and there are a lot of people who have laid criticism in his feed about that number, I think the idea that there's a conceptual limit, a psychological or even a biological limit to the amount of relationships we can maintain while maintaining those relationships meaningfully and valuably, that does make sense.
All right. Now, if I want to scroll down Facebook or Twitter, I can encounter, consume the communication of, I don't know what, 50 different people in 1 minute. How does our brain that's looking for like 15 closies and 150 further aways or whatever the numbers are, what does that do to us when we're getting this fire hose?
Yeah, well, one thing you might notice if you think about the experience you have on social media is that you tend to be less empathetic or to think less about that there's a person on the other end of that conversation. Instead, it turns into an opponent or an enemy or maybe someone you want to align with. And so we kind of transform those connections with other people into resources that we can use to advance our agendas or to confirm our existing beliefs or to reject or react to beliefs that we don't have. In general, we instrumentalize those people and we take the material and kind of ratchet up conflict around it.
We're talking to Ian Bogost about a piece he wrote in The Atlantic, People Aren't Meant to Talk This Much, about social media, how much we consume, how it may be too much for us, and we'll get to this in a bit, maybe different ways to think about how to design and control our interactions on social media in a healthier way. Join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Have you found yourself scrolling and scrolling on whichever your social media of choice is? Does it all blur together? Does it flatten out your relationships with people? Do you think there's a better way? Is the better way turning it off for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go to other possible models, Ian, something that really struck me about your piece is, you know, those close people, whatever the number is, 10, 15, 20, we build that over time. And then
That's
we
right.
might rely on those people more. It really can flatten it out if we just have this flood of people. And you worry that's one of the things that might steer people into, say, a conspiracy theory.
Yeah, one of the things that happens online is everybody kind of looks the same. You know, literally, their profiles look the same as one another. If you bring up someone's Facebook page or their Instagram or Twitter profile, they appear to you the same way that a stranger does. Whereas, you know, when you recognize, you know, a close friend or a family member, all of that sort of meaning that's been built up over many years in that relationship, the reason that you trust those people and that you're willing to take their advice or hear what they have to say and process it based on your past experiences, that takes a long time to establish and you're able to recognize it. But when we have all of these sort of skin deep, constant, small scale interactions with lots of random people and lots of people maybe that you know, but you're not engaging with in that deep, close way that builds further trust, then we're more susceptible to taking their word for things, right? That we treat them as trustworthy interlocutors prematurely.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Elizabeth is with us in Verona. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I don't use social media to connect with my friends or family more, but to get gardening tips and knitting tips and cross-stitch because I don't have anyone life that does it, so it's another way for me to connect to those that enjoy the hobbies I do.
And you restrict your social media use to those interest groups, Elizabeth? That practical stuff?
No, I still have friends and family on my newsfeed for Facebook, but I don't see them. Mm. Like, my whole newsfeed is covered in knitting and cross-stitch and design ideas.
I love it. Elizabeth, thanks a lot for sharing that. And Ian, you talk about some of that in your piece, defining our circles on social media.
Exactly. You know, when you narrow the community that you're interacting with or that can interact with you, one of the things that it does is it allows you to understand and process that information in a more productive way. One way to do that is through common interests. And in fact, you know, communities and message boards around hobbies like knitting, as Elizabeth spoke of, those have been around for a long time online, and they're some of the most productive and healthy communities, or at least they can be, because people know what they're going in for, right? You go there to get knitting advice, and you know, so long as you're a little suspicious maybe of the, I don't know, the political opinions that you hear in your knitting circle, then you're okay, right? And that sense that your circles can be defined, that the software can sort of enforce a smaller community, that's something I'm very interested as a kind of design concept for social media and something that we've seen in the past but sort of abandoned.
Thanks for that call, Elizabeth, at 800-642-1234. Ian, that takes us to a model maybe that didn't survive. Google, was it Plus?
Google Plus, yeah. Google Plus was Google's attempt to make a social network akin to Facebook, which they started designing in the late aughts and rolled out in 2011 or so. And one of the things that some of the designers, including a designer named Paul Adams, who wrote a book about this concept later on, one of the things they looked at was research such as Dunbar's and others that were, you know, looking at the way that sociologists and psychologists establish the kinds of connections we have and what makes them productive. And so on Google Plus, this is a small thing, but a really interesting example of a way of kind of designing this constraint into your online social interactions. They made you, as a user, organize your friends or family into these things they called circles. And that made you kind of go, well, what kind of person is this to me? Is this a family member that I want to share all of my intimate details with? Is this a coworker that I have a different relationship with? Is this one of my knitting friends, you know, that I have yet a different relationship with? And by creating a structure in the service itself that enforced those boundaries, it helped. But over time, you know, we stopped doing that because it didn't produce as much engagement in the software. And of course, Google Plus, the fact that you may not have heard of it before tells you how that story ended.
Talking to Ian Bogost, Program Director in Film and Media Studies at Washington University, author of the book Play Anything. Talk about a piece he wrote in The Atlantic on social media. It may just be too big. We may be interacting with too many people in the same way at the same time. He says we should try some different models. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your relationship with social media? Is there a particular thing you do online that you feel like is a good, healthy form of communication? Are there things that struck you as toxic? Maybe you stopped doing them, scrolling through whatever the feed might be. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Ian Bogost from Washington University, author of the book Play Anything, talking about a piece of his in The Atlantic, exploring what happens to our relationships as humans when we connect with maybe too many other humans on social media platforms. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. Is there a better way, you think, to use social media? How have you controlled the way you use social media? Or is the best way? No way. 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Michelle is with us in Janesville. Michelle, hello.
Hi. So I just want to give a shout out to all of the people who do not use Facebook. Way back in the day when Facebook first came out, and I was very overwhelmed with having to check a personal email and then a work email. And then all my friends were saying, Facebook, Facebook. And I said, oh, I think it's too much for me. I don't think I can manage all of these things. And so I never, ever got a Facebook account. And my husband and I thought we were the last people on earth who were not on Facebook until all of a sudden all of our couple friends are not on Facebook. So we actually get together for dinners and board game nights, and we have face-to-face groups, not Facebook groups.
I love it, Michelle. And it sounds to me like you feel pretty good about that decision.
I feel great about it. I just hear all the drama and all the other things that people talk about Facebook, and I'm really glad that I never did sign up.
All right, I'm a board game fan, Michelle, so you can invite me over sometime maybe. But Ian, that is an option. We can abdicate from the social media system.
It's definitely an option, and you know, as Michelle's story indicates, it's an option that some people don't feel like they're missing out on anything by pursuing, but it's harder than it seems. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, maybe it's not Facebook. You know, Facebook used to be extremely popular with all sorts of communities. Now younger people tend not to use Facebook. They're using Instagram and Snapchat and other services, and there's kind of this, you know, this joke about Facebook having become a social network for boomers, which isn't quite right because they've got billions of users worldwide. But the point I would make here is that it is becoming a luxury to be able to opt out from these systems. They are in large part, or at least in some part, where life happens today. And when you sign out of Facebook or when you close your account, as many people have done in the past number of years, you do miss something. And if you were never there, you might not know that you're missing it. But you know, you stop seeing those stories from your friends or your colleagues. You lose touch with people. And then there's other kinds of services like LinkedIn or what have you, where professional life and recruitment and job opportunities can arise. So I think for a lot of people who aren't ready to take the plunge, like Michelle is, they're aware of this kind of palpable feeling that they would be missing out on something without these services. And that's why companies like Facebook have tried to present their services as almost like utilities that everybody needs just to get by in the contemporary world.
Michelle, thanks a lot for sharing your story at 800-642-1234. Ian, you mentioned with Google Plus, which you saw as maybe a healthier model, it declined because of a lack of engagement. Can you talk about the incentive structure that I think pretty much all social media companies have had to boost engagement at all costs?
Yeah, growth all the time, and growth in all manner of ways. Adding more users, getting those users to interact with the service more often, making those interactions more emotionally amped up, because that tends to draw out more additional participation, comments, and reactions. And of course, all of these things are done in order that engagement can be used as a basis to sell advertising against, which is where Facebook and Google and most of these companies make all their money. So it's mega scale in every way. The total number of users and all of the frequency with which those users are interacting, the amount of material they produce, the acceleration of that material into the hands and fingertips of others. That's where the incentives lie. And you can see why Google Plus, which shut down, was working, you know, a little bit against the grain there. By limiting the way that your posts could get access to other people, that would reduce engagement. So, you know, Facebook took over the the mantle of social media right at a time when it decided to amplify as much as it could to as many people as it could, which is, you know, kind of where all the problems started in my mind.
Talking to Ian Bogost about his piece in The Atlantic on social media, the overwhelming mega scale and what it does to our relationships. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Ian, you think we could do a lot better on social media if we have some, I don't know, breaks or limits or things like that. What kind of experiments would you like to see where constraint might make things better?
Yeah, the simple idea is if this mega scale thing is the problem, then downscale has to be the solution. It's just become almost impossible to think about downscaling social media at all because that's not what it is. That's not what it's become, and that's certainly not where the incentives lie for the companies that run them. So if you think about a platform like Twitter, where you can post as much as you want to as many people as you can find, those posts are constrained. They're limited. There's only a certain number of characters in an individual post. And of course, you could write as many as you want in a day. But that idea of a constraint on Twitter, 280 characters worth of text, that's something that we, when we engage with it, we appreciate. We don't feel like, oh, I'm being prohibited from saying what I want. It's like, how can I get the thing I want to say into this small, pithy remark? And what that tells me is that people are ready to embrace constraint. And in fact, that meaning in general comes from it, right? So imagine if those same kinds of constraints applied to the scale issue. Imagine if you just couldn't reach as many people as you could get, but it was limited to, you know, 280 people or 280 posts a day or a week or a year. Or if you could sort of time out a post. You said something and after a while it just kind of dies and vanishes, right? And some of those experiments have taken place across other platforms, but they've always been curiosities. They haven't been central to the way that people experience their use of social media. And I certainly think there's just a lot more thought and design work to be done that might be more healthy.
If my economic model as a social media company is based on working in bulk, the more data I collect from our users by them posting more stuff, the better I do. How do we change the incentive structure for the companies designing these platforms?
It's a huge problem. And in some ways, you might say, well, you can't change that incentive structure. And that's where this question of intervention and regulation maybe comes into play. There's a lot of discussion about what it might mean to break up Facebook or to regulate social media. And I think a lot of those dreams are impossible to realize. Even if you were to break up Facebook, you'd still have several different companies at mega scale, Instagram and WhatsApp, that are serving the same billions of people and encouraging them to do as much posting and as much interaction as they can. It's also difficult to measure and to kind of create equity in these constraints. Like, oh, the algorithm should be more transparent. That's a story we sometimes hear. What does that mean? And who would police it and how would we know? Whereas enforcing some kind of regulation around scale, around the number of people you can reach or the frequency, maybe it's a terrible idea, but it's at least one worth thinking about because we can imagine it downscaling the system and being enforced on these companies.
Do you see room in the market for, I don't know, artisanal boutique social media platforms? I'm just making this up right now.
No, it's a great question.
To reach out to people and, yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
There have been examples of this. Sometimes there are art projects where you can post to this social network 100 times and that's it in your whole life. And, you know, yes, the problem is as long as megascale exists beside them, it will always win. So, you know, those kinds of artisanal platforms, they become curiosities and, you know, maybe a few people use them. But they don't have the same sort of social and political effect that the 500-pound gorillas do.
Is there something about all these platforms being free, in quotes? You don't pay money for them. You're basically giving your data away. If we paid money for our social media platforms, would we use them in a better way, do you think?
It's a really great point. And you think about how telephones used to work. You know, back when you had to pay for long-distance calls. You kind of thought long and hard, do I need to call grandma this week? Or, you know, you made a call because you needed to and you justified it in relation to the cost you were spending. And the internet made everything free and therefore we could do as much of it as we wanted. And we've always treated that as a net positive. And it is in many ways. But it also created this other problem where because there's no cost to communication, we maybe do too much of it.
as we wrap up, Ian, do you have thoughts for individual users? It's going to take a lot to change the social media landscape. What do you think about as a social media user to make the experience not terrible?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first thing is to recognize that this isn't your fault. That this idea that you have to take on the personal responsibility to intervene in your time management or in your life, I mean, that's just sort of rubbish. You can't do it. I mean, you could maybe try to opt out, but if you're participating, you are being led down the path that these companies want. So instead, see how you can tune the services that you use in the way that that Elizabeth mentioned. You know, I'm only going to use it to talk to these people. I'm going to be deliberate about reducing my friends or only talking to this community on this channel. That's one way that you can start to gain a little bit of control over the system. I think what you'll find in so doing is that those kinds of constraints are pleasurable. You don't lose anything, and in fact, you gain quite a bit from enforcing them.
Ian, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Ian Bogost is a program director in film and media studies at Washington University in St. Louis. Talked to him today about a recent piece he wrote for The Atlantic looking at reining in the mega scale of social media connections.